cutting through the massive disinformation and propaganda to give you the truth about medical and political controversies. This is Truth, Medicine, and Politics with the executive producer of the award-winning film, American Addict, Dr. Gregory A. Smith. To get on air live with your questions or comments, call 800-222-5222. That's 800-222-5222. Or 800-ABC-KABC. And now, Dr. Gregory A. Smith.
I don't know about you, but have you ever sat around with friends and talked about, like, if you had certain superpowers, what you would do? Most people say they'd want to fly. But pretty much everybody, I know I have at several times in my life, talked about things like time travel, how cool it would be to go to a different time, come back, you know, like that movie Back to the Future, where you can go in the future and find out the lottery numbers or the scores of the games and then come back and win a bunch of money. You could have won that Powerball last week for $1.3 billion or something insane like that. But, you know, we tend to think about time travel or going to Mars or things like that. It's just ludicrous or just science fiction. But what if that technology exists? I mean, if you think about it, if any of you went back 50 years with your cell phone and your iPad and maybe dressed a little weird, had some tattoos or whatever, and you appeared in 1940 or 1952 to just regular people, they would probably think that you were an alien. So is it that much out of the realm to think that some of these things exist? So my guest, who I'm going to bring on in a minute tonight, is Andrew Bishago. And Andrew Bishago is a very, very interesting person if you've never heard of him before. First of all, he's running for president of the United States right now. He is an attorney. He UCLA graduate, Cambridge, very well educated. But and I'll let him speak for himself here in a minute. But he has basically been the foremost whistleblower on the United States government in terms of the time travel program. He tells us that time travel, teleportation, these type of technologies have been available since the early 1970s. So I'm going to let him tell you himself. As I always say, I invite you to be open-minded. Have an open mind. Listen, learn, and see what this man has to say. Andrew, are you there?
Yes, I am, Dr. Smith. Thank you for having me on.
Well, listen, I know that you're 3 hours ahead of us, so it's midnight there, so I appreciate you being up late and being on live with us tonight. You know, a lot of the audience may have not have heard of you before, so I just want you to give the audience a little background on yourself, how you got involved in this, talk about Project Pegasus and these things, because you started doing this as a child, is that right?
Correct. I grew up in New Jersey. My late father, Raymond Bishago, was a special projects engineer for the Ralph M. Parsons Company of Pasadena, California, right there in the Los Angeles region. But back in the 60s and early 70s, Parsons was still on Wall Street in New York City. And my dad had gotten involved in furthering the work of Nikola Tesla, specifically his teleportation work, prior to his employment at Parsons. He was employed at the Thomas A. Edison Research Labs in West Orange, New Jersey, from 1956 to 64. And it was in that capacity where he was asked by the U.S. government to revisit Tesla's experimentation with teleportation that went back all the way to his famous stay in Colorado Springs, Colorado in 1899. So they had Nikola Tesla's paperwork from the time of his death on January 7th of 1943 at his apartment at the New Yorker Hotel in Manhattan. And they had done some work with it during World War II, but, you know, the Tesla contribution to electromagnetics, at least secretly, remained moribund for about 25 years. And then in response to the extraterrestrial presence, we became interested in matching the performance of the extraterrestrial craft, and there was a push on in the United States government beginning in the 50s, but then with earnest in the mid-60s, to develop teleportation and other forms of time travel to deal with the extraterrestrial presence. So my father had done that initial work in the 50s, but But by the time he joined Parsons Jordan, which was a subsidiary of Parsons, in 1966, he was actively assigned to the emerging time-space exploration program that was under Parsons. And so I was brought in by my father into the program in the winter of 1968, when as a six-year-old, he drove me up to the old Curtiss Wright Aeronautical Company facility in Woodridge, New Jersey. We checked in and went over to Building 68, which was one of the numbered buildings there. And there was a Tesla device on the shop floor. It consisted basically of two elliptical-shaped, or parenthesis-shaped armatures of the device that were facing each other. And my father explained that when the device was turned on, we would see a form of energy that Nikola Tesla discovered that he called radiant energy, that had among its characteristics the capacity to bend the fabric of time-space, basically to open up vortal tunnels in time-space. And so that when we jumped through that energy field, we would find ourselves traveling through essentially a tunnel in time-space. And we would pop out elsewhere across the country. He didn't tell me where we were going, which in fact was 2,005 miles to the west, namely the state capitol grounds in New Mexico at Santa Fe. He described how we might get lost along the way. In fact, he calved off into another tunnel toward the end of the trip. But that was essentially the way in which I quantum leapt into the emerging time-space program that was underway primarily under Parsons.
And you were 6 years old when you first did this.
Yeah, and in fact, I'm not sure that it was my father's intent necessarily at that point to involve me in the program, because the reason we were jumping to New Mexico is he had a meeting with one of the Manhattan Project physicists, a man by the name of Dr. Harold M. Agnew. Agnew was then the director of the W division at the Los Alamos National Laboratories, the weapons division. He would later go on to become the director of LANL in 1970. But Harold was still working basically as the principal physicist on bomb making. But he had been assigned the role that he would fulfill throughout the early 1970s at least, of being essentially the Federal Science Administrator for this project. So when my dad and I finally met up on in the state capitol grounds there in Santa Fe after getting lost for about a half hour, my dad got a vehicle from one of the state office buildings there, and we drove over to LANL and into a meeting with Harold Agnew. And a very significant conversation was held between my father and this very principal Manhattan Project physicist. I mean, Agnew had been part of all three major phases of the Manhattan Project. He was in the squash courts at the University of Chicago when CP1 was experimented with. In other words, when they took the atomic pile critical, he was actually manipulating one of the graphite rods to prevent the ultimate criticality in an explosion there at the University of Chicago. He was in Los Alamos and Alamogordo when the bomb was designed and tested, and he actually calibrated the ferocity of the Hiroshima blast following the Enola Gay in another plane called the Great Artiste. So Harold had been essentially the prize physics pupil of Enrico Fermi at Chicago and was really one of the more illustrious Manhattan Project physicists, although obviously not a household name. And Harold said to my father, "How was your trip?" And my dad said, "Fine and fast." And Harold looked up, kind of smiling at my dad, and said, "Oh, did you take the teleporter?" And my dad said, "Yep, and so did my young son, Andrew." And he looked over at me on his right side, and Harold looked over at me and asked my father, "How old?" Namely, "How old is your son?" And my dad said, "6. So we know this meeting had to take place between September of 1967 and September of 1968, because I was born in September of 61. And then my dad asked Harold, "Have you tried it yet?" Namely, "Have you teleported yet?" And Harold, being one of the principal figures in the atomic research community, said, "No, but I want to." And I think from that we can infer that Tesla-based teleportation had emerged in the defense technical community, certainly before my father and I went on that trip, but it was still an emerging application that, as illustrious as a Manhattan Project physicist as Agnew, had not yet tried personally. And I think that was somewhat of an historical conversation. At least it allows us to establish that physical teleportation of human beings without injury, at least apparent injury, emerged no later than winter of 1968. So in my late 30s, going back 15 years now, I kind of was impeded in my career. I had passed the bar exam in Washington State after studying at UCLA and Cambridge and earning a law degree at Lewis and Clark Law School up in Oregon. Come back from England, and I was up for a job with the Clinton State Department in environmental diplomacy. And that fell through because of a bureaucratic reason, kind of a minor reason. And so I had experienced something that we all kind of go through at one point in our career, which is basically just career stoppage. I was kind of stalled in my career. And I had a little bit of extra time on my hands, certainly more than I did as a law student or that I've had, you know, for the 15 or 20 years since as a lawyer. And so I began to go back and revisit what had happened to me because I realized, well, wait a minute, this was significant. And I was also operating on a request that my father had made before his death in January of 90, where he urged me to convene a family meeting. I'm from a large family. I have four older siblings, and, you know, so I was number seven when my parents were still alive. And my dad said, I want you to convene a family meeting, and this was literally weeks before his death, and tell everybody in the family what we did, and then tell the entire world. But sort of in the tumult of my life as a law student and then somebody who went on to earn two master's degrees in environmental affairs, I kind of had lost sight of that mission that my father had urged me to pursue. But then as I dug into my memories and pieced everything together, I realized that I had been a direct participant in the emergence of time travel and that I was carrying around information that was literally highly significant to our great American civilization's understanding of what it itself has accomplished.
And people and the general public obviously did not know that. Andrew, we have to take a quick break. My guest tonight is Andrew Bisciago. He is running for president. He is a whistleblower for the time travel and teleportation technology that the government has had for many, many years. And we're going to continue the conversation when we come right back.
You're listening to Truth, Medicine, and Politics with Dr. Gregory A. Smith. To get on the air live with your questions or comments, call 800-222-5222. That's 800-222-5222 or 800-ABC-KABC. We'll be right back right after this break.
Looking to save money on Medicare Part D? Switch your prescriptions to Walgreens. With copays as low as $1, you could be looking at some real savings. And now you can preview the cost of your scripts before you fill with Walgreens' new Medicare prescription copay quote. And that's kind of a big deal. Walgreens, at the corner of happy and healthy.
Quotes subject to change and available only for select Part D plans. $1 copay applies to Tier 1 generics.
GEICO applauds your inner happy camper.
A merit badge of awesomeness goes out to the part of you that wants to put the recreation in recreational vehicle. The part of you that packs up everything and everybody in the RV and says, let's get this show on the road. Because GEICO has specialized agents who help save money on more than just car insurance. GEICO will insure that entire RV, so you can get the s'more-making, poison-ivy-dodging, same-song-singing, ghost-storytelling, campfire-building, best time you ever had with your family, show on the road.
GEICO for your RV. See how much you could save.
Are you one of the many who have worked hard your whole life, only to find yourself struggling as you're facing retirement? Hi, everyone. I'm Fernando Perez with Capital Funding. Fortunately, there is a new program backed by the Federal Housing Administration that may eliminate your house payment. This is not one of those old reverse mortgages, where the bank takes your property with all your equity when you pass away, leaving nothing for your children. With this new program, all of your remaining equity goes directly to your heirs. You can typically qualify with minimal Social Security income. You or your spouse must be at least 62 years old and have equity in your home. It only takes minutes to be pre-qualified, and you may eliminate your house payments for the rest of your life while keeping the equity and title to your home. Questions? Ask us at 888-339-3934. It may be possible to eliminate your house payment and enjoy your life without a mortgage payment while still being able to own your home and pass it on to your children. Call us at 888-339-3934. That's 888-339-3934. Thanks, everyone.
Say, what is this?
You know what it is. 790-790-790-790.
KABC.
Want the truth? You're listening to Truth, Medicine, and Politics with Dr. Gregory A. Smith. To get on the air live with your questions or comments, call 800-222-5222. That's 800-222-5222 or 800-ABC-KABC. And now, Dr. Gregory A. Smith.
My guest tonight is Andrew Bisciago. Not only is he running for president, he's an attorney. He is a major whistleblower for the time travel and teleportation programs the United States has had for many, many years. And Andrew, you were, before we went to the break, you were telling us a little bit about your background, how you got involved in this as a child. There's a lot to talk about. We've only got an hour tonight. So I want to jump up a little bit here to when you were in the Pegasus, Project Pegasus. And again, tell us about that and also what you did in your college days with a person that we now know as Barack Obama.
Right, right. Well, just focusing on Pegasus, I was in Pegasus from 1968 to 1972, which for me was my third, fourth, and fifth grade year. And it was under DARPA. There were eight different forms of what I call quantum access, which is the use of time travel technology to gather intelligence by either sending somebody to a past or future event or modeling that past or future event, or even just that distant event in time space, and basically in space, in the laboratory. So we were doing everything from conventional remote viewing for the Office of Naval Intelligence. They were doing things like spinning us and inducing out-of-body experiences where we were then traveling astrally and they would then question us about what we saw. We were being placed in a device called the Montauk chair, which is basically a magnetic transducer that enhances human psychic performance. So they were sending us on pre-experiences of our own subjective futures, even as adults, and then questioning us about what we saw of the future. But there were also a number of devices, I want to make it clear to your listeners, that were in which we were physically, actually time traveling. So, for example, in addition, by 1970, they manipulated the teleporter itself so they could, that when we jumped across country, we could either arrive in the past or future. They were also utilizing devices called chronovisors to set up holograms that were so dense that they had a lensing effect by which non-local events, that is past or future events, were being brought into the laboratory so that if we stood in that hologram, we spontaneously went to that location, but then they could just collapse the hologram back in the lab and bring us back from, let's say, the past. And there was an advanced teleporter that we were using to access the year 2045 and then bringing microfilm summaries of future events, in other words, events occurring between 1972 and 2045 back. There was another physical time travel technology called the plasma confinement chamber, where you could create, you could utilize basically radioactive plasma to cause a temporary time slip and sort of drop somebody in a past location and so forth. So as I began to catalog my memories, I realized that I was clearly involved in the emergence of different forms of time travel, and what we were doing was new, dangerous, and experimental. And major efforts were made to control us, to make us obedient to authority, to do what we were asked. And what we were doing was very advanced. But the efforts that had been made back when I was on the project as a child to induce me to forget what had happened failed. So as I cataloged my memories, I realized that throughout my schooling, all the way through junior high, high school, college, law school, graduate school, I had been making references to my experiences. To my friends, some of my professors knew. But then there was a part of my experience that was sort of calved off in my unconscious that had been successfully blocked. And so after I became a public figure in 2009 with my first appearance on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie, I was contacted by two individuals, William Stillings and Bernard Mendez, who I had served with on a second secret defense project during the years that I was at UCLA as a history major during the day division and as basically a naval strategic intelligence major in the evening division. And what they described is that they didn't know me from Pegasus back in the late 60s and early 70s. They knew me from a set of secret technical activities that had taken place in the early 1980s. And they had known me not as a child, but as a UCLA student. And they described, and we began to compare notes, and we were able to jog each other's memories and get around the memory blocks regarding the CIA's Mars Jump Room program. They had one of the time travel devices was essentially a device that was a dual use of a standard elevator that you would get to go from, let's say, ground floor to the fifth floor of any office building in L.A. The jump room device in Los Angeles was actually at 999 North Sepulveda and Imperial Avenue East and West. It was a Hughes building right across the southern border of LAX in El Segundo there. And that device worked by we would stand in the elevator, and then the elevator would morph from its normal box-like shape into a cylinder. There would be kind of a wormholing effect on the opposite wall of the elevator. And we would actually be convoluted with this spiral convolution of the box-like elevator into a cylinder. We actually had to steady ourselves by holding onto the wall, just like when you walk through a water main. I'm sure some of the LADWP employees in your listenership could identify with that. And when the device righted itself in about 20 minutes, the opposite wall would open up, and we were in an underground base on either Mars or some celestial body somewhere in the universe that they had mistaken for Mars. I mean, I have no way of absolutely establishing that it was the red planet, but we were certainly trained for Mars. So working with William Stillings and Bernard Mendez, I spent most of 2012, or a large part of it, in dozens of Skype teleconferences with them, where we went back and established who we were trained with, what we did on Mars, who we were jumping to from the El Segundo site. There was also a jump room site at the CIA complex near the George Washington Bridge in New York City. There was an East Coast and a West Coast jump site.
So your memories were gone from this. You're saying that before 2009, you had remembered Project Pegasus, but you had not remembered all this. So this was all new to you.
Actually, I had defeated the memory blocking on Pegasus as a child, so I had brought that forward, seldom talking about it, because when I talked about it to my best friends, you know, at Chatsworth High School out in the Valley or my fellow Bruins at UCLA, imagine people's natural reaction. When you start claiming that you were in a federal time travel project, naturally that invites incredulity. And so I got so much negative responses, normal responses from people making such claims that I just stopped talking about it, but I never forgot it. But in the sort of the hurly-burly of being a UCLA undergrad and then a law student, graduate student, really finally emerging professionally in my early 30s, I think I spent pretty much, most of the time between age 17 when I left home in Chatsworth to age 32, those 15 years, earning six post-secondary credentials. So I was keeping my mind very busy, but I had been blocked about the fact that in the summer of 1980, my father and I traveled from our home in Chatsworth up to Northern California, up to the Mount Shasta region, and I was placed in a training program with 11 co-trainees, actually 10 including myself, five of whom, besides myself, we've been able to identify. In addition to Bernard and William, they included Barack Obama, utilizing the name, his Indonesian identity, Barry Satoru, the woman who had just entered Caltech as a 16-year-old, who was now 17 by summer of 80, who Obama appointed the first female director of DARPA in 2009, namely Regina E. Dugan, who I think now is at Google, and the pilot of the space shuttle Columbia, who tragically died during that catastrophe in 2003, William McCool. So we identified five of the 10 young people, and then, of course, Bernard Mendez was an older individual who had been dropped into the program to kind of answer some questions about what was going on in the program. He was sort of a federal investigator of the project itself, but also a co-participant. So we've identified six of the 11 trainees.
Andrew, we're up against another break. This is good stuff. You mentioned Barack Obama was in this with you. Let's when we come back, we're going to come back to that. My guest tonight is Andrew Bishago, time traveler, whistleblower really for the government, secret programs for time travel and travel to Mars, teleportation, also running for president of the United States. We will be back with him after these messages.
You're listening to Truth, Medicine, and Politics with Dr. Gregory A. Smith. To get on the air live with your questions or comments, call 800-222-5222. That's 800-222-5222 or 800-ABC-KABC. We'll be right back right after this break.
There are times being a genius would really come in handy.
Karen, final question. You'll either walk out of here with $1 million or nothing. In what year did the Hicksonian Astrophysical Capital City fourth president invented? You have 5 seconds.
But thankfully, you don't need to be a genius to do your own taxes, because TurboTax helps turn complicated questions into simple ones that you can answer. Intuit TurboTax. Taxes done smarter.
We already have the best deals on hardwood flooring, but those deals just got even better at Lumber Liquidators' January flooring sale. Right now, you can get 20% off our already low prices on our thickest and best laminate. And our natural maple laminate is an unbeatable 49 cents. That's 50% off. Or get beautiful Bellawood 3/4 inch solid prefinished Brazilian Koa at 40% off. Gorgeous engineered hardwood like gunstock oak up to 50% off. Plus, get more great deals starting at just 59 cents and get special financing. Hurry before these deals are gone. Visit LumberLiquidators.com to find a store near you.
If your credit card debt is out of control, if you're in over your head dealing with monthly payments, there's a powerful secret the credit card companies don't want you to know. If you have more than $5,000 in credit card debt, you have the right to settle that debt for a fraction of what you owe. That's bad news for credit card companies, but it's great news for you. We're NetDebt, and we're offering you free information on how to virtually eliminate your credit card debt and make your monthly payment affordable. To see how much you could save, call now, 1-800-551-3344. Don't declare bankruptcy. Give us 10 minutes and we could save you thousands. We depend on your success and offer a guarantee, so there's no risk. Net debt. Live better debt-free. Find out how easy it is by calling now. For the secret the credit card companies don't want you to know, call Net Debt now and see how much money you could save for free. Call 1-800-551-3344. That's 1-800-551-3344.
Talk Radio 790.
KABC. Want the truth? You're listening to Truth, Medicine, and Politics with Dr. Gregory A. Smith. To get on the air live with your questions or comments, call 800-222-5222. That's 800-222-5222 or 800-ABC-KABC. And now, Dr. Gregory A. Smith.
My guest tonight is Andrew Bishago. He is a time traveler. He is a whistleblower for the Project Pegasus, for other projects. Really, the secret technologies that the government has had in their coffers here for many, many years. And he's also running for president. I think your website, Andrew, is andy2016.com. That's andy2016.com for his presidency. Now, before we took the break, you mentioned, I think you said the name was Barry Sator.
Sator. Now, if I was making up a tall tale, why as a lawyer educated at UCLA and Cambridge, would I be so unwitting as to include the current sitting president of the United States, our 44th president, Barack Obama? The reason I have is not to put a spin on the story, but because it's true. I've been operating on the basis of the truth principle. What happened is we realized that Barry Satoru, the young man attending Occidental College, who had ties to Hawaii, we met his mother or adoptive mother, Stanley Ann Dunham, because the parents were sometimes auditing the training class in summer of 80. So we thought, my God, this was Obama. Okay. Now, we knew that at the time of my fourth appearance on Coast to Coast AM, which was on November 10th of 2011. And on that show, I appeared with William Stillings, my fellow Mars jumper, and with Laura Magdalene Eisenhower, the great-granddaughter of President Eisenhower, who described how in 2006 and 7, a major effort was made to recruit her to the secret U.S. colony on Mars. And in fact, Laura used the technical term ARC, and she didn't realize that they were trying to explain to her how she would actually get to Mars via jump room, because ARC was provided to us as a term in our training. It stands for Aeronautical Repositioning Chamber, the jump room itself. Okay, so we appeared, and William Stillings corroborated my account. Laura showed how 25 years on after our jump room experiences in the early 80s, she is a member of a U.S. presidential family, and her two twin boys were invited to resettle on Mars. And several weeks later, the president of the United States, in an unprecedented move, asked the spokesperson for the National Security Council, who was then Tommy Veeder, the very person who had headed up his controversy regarding the certificate of live birth and the president's nationality. He had Tommy Veeder plant an article in Wired.com magazine online in which the president of the United States denied going to Mars and ridiculed me as the secret chrononaut that wanted the American public to know this thing. Now, look, doctor, I mean, you're a physician, so you can understand human motivation and mental states and so forth. If what we were talking about, namely that Barack Obama was a participant in the secret space program, could readily be dismissed as an urban legend or a conspiracy theory. I mean, look, there are 330 million Americans. I am one of them. I am one over 330 million. If what I was saying in both mainstream and alternative media at that point could readily be laughed off as an urban legend or a conspiracy theory, particularly in that kind of snarky culture that Beltway politics goes on in, why would the White House, why would literally the president and the National Security Council, such a rarefied group of our top leadership, why would they find it necessary to deny what I was saying? Okay, mm-hmm. I had not yet served in public office even. I was a lawyer from Washington State, some impressive degrees, some academic publications in environmental affairs, but I was not a household name by any means. And yet, if anybody doubts my claim that President Obama served in the secret space program and this was actually the major cover-up of his presidency, then just go back to that January 4th, 2012 article in Wired.com where his administration denied his involvement in the Mars jump room program.
Do you think he even remembers, though, because you're saying that they made an effort to sort of wipe memories. Is it
to block our memories? Yeah.
Yeah. Is it possible he just doesn't even remember that he was in the program?
Actually, I know he remembers, and let me tell you how we found that out. Bernard Mendez is a career intelligence officer. I am not. I'm simply a young person who was served in one of these projects in childhood and then during my college years, and I went on to a career as a lawyer. I've never been even officially employed by the CIA or any of the alphabet intelligence agencies, although I'm obviously more aware of how they function because of the two secret defense projects that I served in. What happened is Bernard, using his rather deep connections in Washington, Bernard Mendez, kind of the Indiana Jones of human ET contact is how his career really played out, utilizing an intermediary to President Obama, communicated with the president. And what came back from Mr. Obama is that he remembered being in the project. He remembered me vividly because, after all, we had actually roomed together for a period of time during our training in 1980. We had jumped together from the El Segundo jump room, and we had served together with Bernard Mendez in a team of three on the surface of where they were sending us. So I was sort of a principal, and Barry was sort of a principal in my set of experiences in the jump room program. But that now, looking back at 30 years removed, 36 years now from when we began, the president stated that his memories were vague and dreamlike, indicating that he also probably was subjected to efforts to block his memories. But then he promised us, through the intermediary, that when he leaves the presidency, he will acknowledge his involvement. I think maybe the major hang-up of why he didn't want to come forward publicly is he is, after all, the commander-in-chief of our nation's military forces. And these projects, including the Jump Room program, were secret defense projects, not just research projects. They all have national security-related goals. In the case of the Jump Room program, it was to establish a defense regime on Mars, protecting our planet from all of the above, hostile extraterrestrial creatures, asteroids that might hammer our planet again like they did 11,500 years ago, etc. So I think that being a very cautious political leader, President Obama decided to say to us, look, I will keep faith with you guys. You served your country in a very terrifying program ultimately, and we all could have died up there, so I will come forward ultimately, but I can't do so as president. That was basically his message.
So when he's out of office, he's going to make some kind of a public announcement or acknowledge that he was in this program?
I don't know whether he's going to honor his promise. It may have just been to silence us vis-a-vis the Obama connection during his presidency regarding the Mars Jump Room program. I would certainly be delighted if he appeared on 60 Minutes and described what happened, because, again, just like my experiences in childhood in Project Pegasus, the Mars Jump Room program was essentially the initial human experience in the exploration of another planet in our solar system, beyond the initial, putting 12 men on the moon. So this was really a major exploration, exploration, habitation, and ultimately potentially colonization of another planet in our solar system, not just the moon. And so I think that, what I've been guided by here is my sense that I was under an ethical duty to reveal the two projects that I served in, because as to Project Pegasus and the advent of time travel, I believe that it's as part of the common heritage of humankind that not just Americans but all world citizens have a right to know how advanced our technologies have gotten so that they can make wise decisions, for example, as voters. And just for the heuristic benefit of knowing where our civilization has actually gone as of today. And then regarding the Mars Jump Room program, I think there's a similar right that we all possess as human beings in this civilization to know the most accurate information about the nature of the cosmos that we inhabit. For example, we were not just going to Mars. We were going to a Mars that is an inhabited planet. It's sparsely inhabited. It's a desert planet. It has very little vegetation, very little water, but it has several types of humanoids and about 30 major land animal species. So there are ethical and environmental ethical questions that obtain about our Earthling presence on the red planet. None of that has gone addressed, however, and there's never been a nexus that has been developed by the White House press corps in pursuing this story to the detriment of our understanding of the career of Barack Obama, because, again, as I discussed this morning with you when we were chatting on the phone, and this is, again, one of the reasons I'm speaking out, is our common culture is in somewhat of a crisis. And that crisis emerged as the result of official state secrecy. I would argue the abuse of official state secrecy. And what has happened is that the publican institutions of our civilization, the political leadership, the predominant political leadership, the media, academia, science, is not aware of what our civilization itself has actually accomplished secretly. So when an individual like myself, with no history of drug abuse, no criminal history, no history of alcohol abuse, no DUIs out there on my driving record, when I come forward, no matter how above reproach I've lived my life, if something is strange enough, it automatically denotes low credibility in a civilization that has been lying to itself about what it itself has accomplished.
Right. It's hard for people to understand. I know what we said before is it's hard for people. They've been programmed in such a way. It's hard for people to accept this kind of information. We're up against a break again, Andrew. We're going to keep talking about that. And when we come back from the break, I really want to give you a little bit of time to talk about your run from the White House and the message you want to get out to people. My guest tonight is Andrew Bishago. We will be right back after these messages.
You're listening to Truth, Medicine, and Politics with Dr. Gregory A. Smith. To get on the air live with your questions or comments, call 800-222-5222. That's 800-222-5222 or 800-ABC-KABC. We'll be right back right after this break.
The Kings are on a mission to reclaim their throne.
Kopitar wins the draw. Muzzin pulls the trigger on a shot. He scores!
Don't miss a second of the action as the Kings go for their third cup in 5 years.
Defaulted to the net, shoots, scores!
Kings, Ducks, Sunday at 5:30 on your home for Kings Hockey. 790 KABC.
My name is Tom Thornton.
And my name is Cindy Thornton. We've been married 38 years. We're retired, and this is how we live united.
We play golf and we travel, but we also decided we were going to give to and volunteer with United Way at our community free health clinic.
I do the nursing at the clinic.
I work the front office, checking in patients, greeting them, making them feel comfortable.
United Way is how we contribute, because we know our time and money are going to the right places, the places that need it most and implement it best.
Judging by the thank yous we get at the clinic, I'd say we're doing the right thing with our retirement, too.
We even get a few bless yous. It's incredible.
We're Tom and Cindy Thornton. We volunteer at our community free health clinic, so we don't just wear the shirt.
We live it.
Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Talk radio.
790 KABC.
Want the truth? You're listening to Truth, Medicine, and Politics with Dr. Gregory A. Smith. To get on the air live with your questions or comments, call 800-222-5222. That's 800-222-5222 or 800-ABC-KABC. And now, Dr. Gregory A. Smith.
And we are in the last segment with Andrew Bisciago, running for President of the United States. He's also a whistleblower, was in the Project Pegasus, participated in time travel to different times, future and the past, Mars travel. Andrew, as I told you earlier, we're going to have to bring you back again and do a longer show because we don't even have really time for questions. I really wanted to give you an opportunity to tell the listeners about yourself. And we're in the last segment here. You are running for president.
Right.
Well, tell us why.
Yeah, when I realized that teleportation, for example, is going to have to be a necessary element by which our global civilization will address the crisis of environment and development that's already fomenting. I mean, we're going to be going from, 7 billion human beings to 9 billion human beings by 2045, the next 29 years, next 30 years. And then when I began investigating how beneficial the introduction of teleportation would be if we simultaneously end our reliance on the internal combustion engine to power planes, trains, and automobiles, I found an interesting statistic, which is that if we do that, we will remove from the global atmosphere 60% of the greenhouse gases that result from human industry. We're also confronted by the limits to growth in the transportation sector just from the fact that our population growth is congesting the settled areas where we have transportation systems. Let me just cite one example. In 2010, a 50-lane freeway in China was congested, literally it was stopped for 6 days. There were tens of thousands of Chinese nationals living in their cars for 6 days, being served by a phalanx of police officers, by hundreds of police officers, bringing them food, water, blankets, so that they could live in their cars until the traffic stoppage was ameliorated. Okay, every inhabitant of the civilized world is confronting such a future ultimately, unless we make a transition to teleportation, at least in terms of getting the vehicles that transport goods off of our major thoroughfares. Okay, so when I realized that we're in this strange paradox where claims like mine are still heretical about what we've secretly accomplished, but that we could have had literally a teleportation-based culture since 1970. We could have been restricting greenhouse gas emissions and provided more than a 50% solution, a 60% solution to what we can affect from 1970, literally the year that Vice President Gore began studying the greenhouse problem under Dr. Roger Revelle at Harvard College. You know, imagine living in a civilization where instead of taking 24 hours to fly from London, England to Sydney, Australia, you could go in seconds. Well, such a world has been available since 1970, and yet we haven't even begun the discussion of those capabilities. So while I'm running for president in 2016 on a set of 100 proposals, 100 progressive proposals to bring about positive change, I'm leading with my call for the declassification and deployment of teleportation simply because we're going to have to be doing that. In other words, instead of driving or flying somewhere, somebody would go into a local building that would look sort of like an elevator, and when the door opened, they would be somewhere else. Or they would go to, let's say, LAX, and instead of walking aboard a plane, they would walk aboard a similar seating area, but then that seating area would then teleport rather than fly to their destination. Now, I visited 2045 when I was serving on Project Pegasus as a child, and it was a quiet 2045 with blue skies and fresh air. I could hear the birds chirping every time I visited the building that they were sending me to. There were no cars, no planes up in the sky, because we had, at least on that timeline, we had made the right choices in the present and adopted teleportation and used it as a major solution in the crisis of environment and development that's upon us. As a presidential candidate, I've pledged, for example, to end the chemtrail spraying on my first day in office. Well, why did Edward Teller recommend that we do the chemtrail spraying? It was to increase the albedo effect of the planet, to bounce more solar radiation back into space, to arrest global warming so that the Gulf Stream wouldn't fail and we wouldn't have a sudden cold snap and possibly even a return to a new ice age, as described by Whitley Strieber and Art Bell in their book, The Coming Global Superstorm. That's why we are covertly spraying our skies. Okay, so this emergency that needs presidential leadership is already upon us, and I disagree with the solutions that have been employed. So I made a major decision to take my truth campaign about time travel, about the fact that we've already reached Mars, and run for president so that at least in the 2016 election, I can begin to educate the electorate and the American people generally about the fact that these programs were actually undertaken, and this is in the nature of what our civilization has secretly accomplished. And I think I'm a little bit ahead of the curve on that, because I found that at the recent Contact in the Desert event out near Joshua Tree, the number one issue that was being polled, that attendees to that very sort of rarefied group of involved, committed, bright people that tend to attend Contact in the Desert, you know, it's a pretty high caliber audience there. The number one public policy issue that most people were concerned about was the United States government's concealment of life-advantaging technology, teleportation, cancer cures, et cetera. So I think I'm a little bit ahead of the transition we're going to be seeing, where the cultural creative demographic niche is going to go national and become the primary demographic niche by which people shape their worldview and vote for their presidential choices and so forth. So my hour of opportunity for the presidency may be, in fact, in 2020, but I decided to sort of play the game ahead and at least acquaint the electorate with the fact that these claims I'm making are, in fact, true, and there are important public policy decisions that we need presidential leadership on to address these areas of what technologies have been sequestered, what would be the benefit of declassifying them, how far has the secret space program actually gone to not just visiting other celestial bodies but possibly terraforming them, What are the national and international security implications of those types of activities? I'm going to try to sort of close the gap here, bridge the gap, and try to prevent the breakaway civilization from occurring by running for president in 2016 and again in 2020 if I have to, if I don't win this time, just so that we have a chance of making a smooth transition to a world that works for everybody, not just our too-big-to-fail corporations.
Well, isn't those too-big-to-fail corporations that are going to stand in the way? Because obviously, if teleportation exists like this and is used commercially, what happens to the automobile industry? What happens to the big oil companies? What happens to the airline industry? It all goes away, basically, or at least
is
diminished.
This is why these technologies were viewed as disruptive, even when I was a small boy serving on Project Pegasus. The concern was that if they would be introduced, there would be all of the negative effects, such as joblessness, from their introduction. That implies that we have to make related intelligent choices. I would cite to an audience of Californians that it was really Governor Jerry Brown of California who has been the only major politician in the world who has cited the fact that even without the introduction of these kinds of disruptive technologies, disruptive because they would render people unemployed, just the ordinary advance of technology embodied in things like the personal computer revolution is so displacing individuals in the workforce that we have to really start seriously talking about things like a guaranteed income, because the major thrust of our technical development is to do more with less. And so, for example, in the case of personal computers, every time one computer is placed in an office, the work that was being done by two people can now be done by one. So every new computer represented another American, another Californian on unemployment. So we can't just look at the technical side of this. We have to figure out how to create a stakeholder society where we have things like a minimal guaranteed income. We have to figure out what the major employers, like the car companies, the airlines, the oil industry, what they will be involved in. And there are things that they can be involved in. For example, we can have the car manufacturers transition to electrical cars so that the existing transportation grid that we have that is automobile-based can still be used for a next generation of vehicles when people don't want to teleport. They simply want to, you know, visit their grandmother across town and let the wind blow in their hair when they go there. Okay, and we'll also have to involve the existing airline industry with the airports and so forth in the management and operations of the teleports. For example, you know, every time new technology is introduced, there's also the countervailing effect of new industries. And one of the things that teleportation will do, especially with the internet, is it will allow us to ship goods so efficiently and so inexpensively that shipping of goods will boom. So some of the individuals currently employed in the transport sector can be moved over to the shipping sector and be handling goods at depots and that sort of thing.
That's a very
depots
good point.
In time space, if you will. But we're going to have to start asking these hard choices, because who among us who has experienced the kind of traffic stoppages where you might lose 2 days of your 24-hour existence, you know, getting from your job in downtown L.A. To your home in Valencia, who among us will want to live in such a society when the traffic stoppages will go on for days, such as they did during that example in China in 2010? It's not a tenable future. In other words, it's truly not a sustainable future if we continue to rely on the automobile.
Right.
And the freeway.
Andrew,
we're going to have to make hard choices.
And we're going to have to leave it there. We are out of time. Andrew Bisciago, my guest tonight, running for president. Check out his website, andy2016.com. Thank you so much for coming on. We're going to have to bring you back so we can get some questions, but I appreciate you staying up late and being on the show tonight, Andrew. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me, Dr. Smith, and I look forward to future visits with you.
Excellent, excellent. If you've missed any of this, you can go to drgregorysmith.com to hear the podcast. We decide to release the movie American Addict 2 for free. So if you haven't seen it, you can also go to drgregorysmith.com. That's drgregorysmith.com. Check out any of the archived radio shows and watch American Addict 2 for free.